I thought I'd open up by saying a few words. I'm Narayana Coach Lakota. I'm president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. And I'd like to provide a little context for the reasons behind my visit to Fargo today. The United States Central Bank is an unusually decentralized central bank. And so, and in keeping with that, the United States is divided up into 12 districts with 12 headquarters offices in various cities across the United States. And Minneapolis is the headquarters for the 9th district of the Federal Reserve System. That 9th district includes the state of Montana, states of North and South Dakota, Minnesota, northwestern Wisconsin, and the upper peninsula of Michigan. So it's a very far-flung district, as you can tell by my description. One way to see that is, as I'll describe in a second, I go to Federal Open Market Committee meetings in Washington 8 times per year. And I also go to Helena, where we have a branch office of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. And actually, it takes me as long to fly to Helena as it does to fly to Washington. So that gives you a feel for how big our district is geographically. In terms of population, we are, in fact, the smallest of the 12 districts, though, at just under 9 million people. So why then do we have these districts? Why is the Federal Reserve System as decentralized as it is? It's in order to facilitate, I think, better two-way communication between the people of the country and the Central Bank of the United States. And part of that, what do I mean by two-way communication is, I think it's important for a central bank to be listening to its citizens in order to have a better feel for what's going on in the economy, what we expect to be happening in the economy. The aggregate information we see is usually very backwards looking, it's lags. And it doesn't tell us where things are gonna be coming around the pike, or around the corner, I should say. And that's, I think, one of the roles that my job is to help the central bank is to provide, get that kind of local information, and in so doing, have a better feel for what's going to be happening in the country, its economy as a whole. And in keeping with that, when the Federal Open Market Committee meets, and that's the committee that makes monetary policy for the United States, all 12 Federal Reserve Bank presidents take part in those meetings, as well as the governors who sit in Washington. And we bring forward the local information that we've gathered and our staffs have gathered as part into that meeting and use that as part of the conversation to form our picture for the whole committee of what's going on in the national economy. So in Fargo this morning, I met with business leaders to get a feel for what's happening in this local economy. And I also met with local community leaders to get another picture from another perspective. In terms of really talking about some of the opportunities and challenges in the Fargo housing market from another perspective of what's happening in your local economy. Now, the other piece of two-way communication, what I've been talking about up until now is the listening component. The other part is that this evening I'll be giving a talk and as well as taking questions and answering those questions. And that's the other piece of two-way communication I think that's very important is the people in our district have the opportunity to hear from a representative of the Federal Reserve System about what the system is doing, how monetary policy is working, and I think getting that personal contact is also very important. So that's the reason I'm in Fargo today, is to facilitate exactly that kind of two-way communication, listening to what's going on in the national economy, in the local economy as a way to get a better picture of what's happening nationally, and then as well, talking to people this evening about what's going to be what the course of monetary policy is and the thinking that's going on behind that. But now I'm happy to take any questions that the media might have. Yeah.
What was the temperature of the community gathered from just the folks you've talked to so far?
Yeah, I think that this is a very healthy economy. Unemployment is very low. It's below 4% in this area. I think with that said, I think businesses also feel the imprint of the national economy, and some of the uncertainties at that level are certainly still impinging on economies in the local area, businesses in the local area. But the local economy is very strong, very healthy. People have a lot of confidence in it. With that said, I think there's also some challenges that represents, and that was the second piece of our conversation to, that we were having with community leaders, is that, you know, that there's a demand for workers, those workers need places to live, or you need to build houses sufficiently rapidly to house those workers and their families. And so the strength of the economy introduces some challenges as well. So I think it's important to have both sides of that in mind as we're thinking about things. But generally, the one word answer that I would give to your question is healthy.
And what can Federal Reserve banks do to improve conditions for the folks who have uncertainties about the national picture?
That's a good question. I think we can be clear about the course of our own policy choices and be as clear as possible about that. Talk about what are the conditions that will lead to the adjustment of our policy tools, and talk about the conditions, what we're trying to achieve in terms of our use of our policy tools. Right now, our goal for inflation is to maintain inflation at 2%, and inflation is running below that right now, closer to 1%. And at the same time, the other of our goals is to promote maximum employment. And one can talk about how close we are to maximum employment, but I think we're still a ways away from that. And I think we should be doing all that we can to be as clear as possible that our accommodative stance is going to remain in place until we've seen much better achievement in terms of our goals.
Yeah. You talked about challenges for the local economy. What are some of the key challenges?
Yeah, I think it's the challenges that come with being a strong economy. And what I'm thinking about there are shortages of workers in some areas of some sectors of the economy. I think there's upward pressure on rents, on housing prices. These are the pressures that come with having a robust, growing economy. And I think time will ameliorate some of these. I think supply will adjust to meet demand, but it does take time for that to happen.
I think it was about a year ago, the Fed put out a report about the ripple effects of the Bakken oil boom. Over that time, as we look at the region, have those ripples changed? Have they deepened or widened? Or?
That's a good question. The short answer is that we're still tracking that on an ongoing basis. I think we're starting to see a little bit of widening of that, but it's certainly not. When I think about what's happening in Fargo, that's far enough away that I wouldn't think of that as being a sizable effect. The way it impacts Fargo the most, I would say, is that the state economy is very healthy, so your state government is in a very healthy place. And that has a positive impact on all communities in North Dakota, not just in the western part. But certainly you can point to parts of the Fargo economy that are probably being impacted in some ways by what's happening in the west. But it's that's not the dominant story of what's happening here. Yeah.
You talked about making clear what the Fed's policies are so people have some confidence. What are some of the policies you feel are having the strongest effect in? Can you spell out what effect they have and what some of these tools are that you referred to?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So right now, the Fed is using two tools, one of which is quite conventional and the other is less so. So our usual tool is to target a short-term interbank lending rate. And by varying that rate that we're targeting, we're able to vary the credit conditions that apply to the economy more generally. So at this point in time, and since December 2008, that rate has been being targeted between 0.25 percentage point, which is about as low as you can go. And at the same time, we are conducting asset purchases. These asset purchases are purchases of longer-term assets issued or backed by the government. And by buying these, we're putting more direct pressure on long-term interest rates, trying to push them downwards. And so both of these are moving in the same direction, making credit conditions more accommodative. The way this shows up for households is that it'll make mortgages cheaper. It will thereby put upward pressure on housing prices. It makes car loans cheaper, and that stimulates demand in the auto sector. So these are the most direct ways you see Fed policy working, I would say. Really any kind of consumer durable that you might want to finance, or if you're choosing between keeping your money in a bank account or buying a consumer durable of some kind, again, the policy and the stimulus works, is a work there. Any kind of stimulus like that pushes upward on prices and employment, and that moves us closer to our goals. I think the main kind of communication that we have in place now is there's a lot of conversation around the country that, boy, the Fed has had these accommodative tools in place for a long time now. I just mentioned how the interbank lending rate, the Fed funds rate, we've been keeping it at between 0 and 0.25 percentage point for over 5 years now. And there, you'll hear a lot of policy conversation out there that say, boy, the Fed should start to change. If they were to raise rates, somehow that would make the economy better. That's very dangerous conversation. I think we have to be convincing that we're going to be staying in an accommodative course, keeping our tools in place, even as the economy recovers. And that will give people confidence that that recovery will be more rapid, and that by itself is a form of stimulus. And so these are all these things have to work together, and I think the key is for us to maintain an accommodative stance and communicate they're willing to maintain an accommodative stance even as the economy continues to recover.
Yeah. In a robust economy like North Dakota's, do those tools have less impact than in other areas where the economy may be weaker?
I think that actually, I think you could give arguments both ways. I think that the tools are effective in both situations. How the relative effectiveness is a little more challenging to sort out. I mean, I think, you know, you can certainly tell a story where if a number of people are having a hard time getting mortgages, then it's because their income prospects are challenged for some reason. Then our tools, which are partly working through that access to making mortgages cheaper, aren't going to be as effective. So that makes them work better in a stronger economy. On the other hand, you can give other arguments where the tools wouldn't be as effective in a stronger economy. On balance, I think that I think of our tools as pointing in the same direction in both places. I think what the way I would really want to answer your question though is by saying that the tools are not as important in North Dakota because the sources of growth and the sources of strength are strong enough that you don't need these outside sources of stimulus as much.
Yeah. Sir, many of your folks in attendance tonight will be NDSU students.
Yeah.
Some of them, commencement's only a month away. They'll be entering the marketplace. Do you have a message for them or insights that you'll be sharing with them as to what they might expect?
Well, I think they should look at be thinking about the long haul. And the long haul is a positive one. I think the long haul in the United States is a very positive one. The key to taking advantage of those positive things that are going to be coming to the United States over the long haul, though, is not viewing this commencement as your last commencement. There's going to be more opportunities to get more education, and people should be availing themselves of that. Because I think that my experience over the last, you know, I won't say how many years, but a long number of years is things continue to change. You have to keep yourself open and to learning and keep yourself open to educating yourself about those changes. And so the key to being successful over the longer haul and as the economy continues to evolve is going to be that willingness to keep oneself re-educated and relearning.
Talk a little about how you see the diversity in the strengths of the economy in this region. The oil boom right now gets all the attention, but how do you see the economy as far as diversity?
Well, I think that that's a good question. I think that, I think North Dakota continues to diversify. It continues to become a stronger economy in that way. Certainly here in Fargo in particular, you really have a sense of a very diverse economy in a number of different respects. And I think that North Dakota does have to continue to have a vision of a time when oil will not be as dominant a piece of the economy as it is right now. And thinking about being a part of the human, really, the world as a whole is going to be more human capital intensive. That's been the story of development over the last 200 years, is that education plays and human capital play more and more of a role in being successful in the economy. And that right now, the success for North Dakota is bound up in oil. That will not be true forever. And the question is, how do you use the oil benefits now to put yourself in a better position to be a part of that human capital intensive economy down the road?
So what sort of things should leaders here be thinking about doing then to prepare for that human intensive capital?
Human capital intensive really is about being ready in terms of educational opportunities for your citizens. That's where productivity is going to come from, where growth is going to come from, where earning potential is going to come from down the road.
I'll just shout one out based upon what Steve asked earlier. North Dakota students have approximately $27,000 in student debt when they get out of school, one of the highest in the nation. Do you have any recommendations to them in terms of should they put it in fixed or variable rate? Because there's
I do not make recommendations of that kind. I didn't when I was an economics professor, and I certainly don't now.
I believe your predecessor was bullish on pre-K education, to go back to your comment about an educated society is really where you should put your money. Do you continue to have that philosophy as he did?
So that was actually my director of research, Art Rolnick, who that was really part of his independent research that he was doing while he was working at the Federal Reserve. And I found his research quite compelling. But I think that's certainly one avenue that leaders should be thinking about as they try to grow a more educated population. But I think it's one mechanism, one channel. There's a number of different possibilities, I think. But certainly arts research is very, very interesting, very compelling research.
In the short term, with housing challenges, is that fairly limited still, or are you seeing housing challenges extend maybe beyond even the borders of North Dakota related to the oil boom and the economy?
I think we're starting to see housing improvements, housing pickup around the country, and I think certainly these the kinds of challenges that you see in North Dakota are unusual relative to the rest of the United States, simply because of how strong the economy is here.
But do those challenges affect neighboring? Is Minnesota in any way affected by that?
I imagine if you get right into the neighboring communities, you're going to see some of those effects. But these kinds of effects are going to start to die out very rapidly as you cross state lines. I should say, Minnesota also has a quite a healthy economy. Unemployment rate for the state is noticeably under 5%. This is again very healthy by national standards. But not as strong as I don't think is what you're seeing here in Fargo or in North Dakota more broadly. Yeah.
We live just by Canada, and globalization is part of the factor that really gets everybody worried in terms of financial markets. How should we be concerned with a global economy that is really unstable when it comes to most of some countries in Europe and
So there's two pieces to your question. One piece of the question is about the integration of financial markets and how that integration of financial markets mean that what happens in Europe ends up influencing our economies. And that's the job of our banking supervisors and regulators, is to really try to monitor the financial system so as to make sure that it's as safe as possible from those kinds of shocks. And I think we're doing a much better job on that than we did before the crisis, is what I'm trying to say, before 2007. The other piece of it, though, is that I think it's very important when we're thinking about ourselves as workers in the economy, is to be thinking of ourselves as workers in the global economy. And that means that when we're thinking about who we're competing with and who young people are competing with, they're not competing just with people in Minnesota, people in California. It's really they're thinking about being competing with this global economy that you made reference to. I think it offers a very different, often when I hear a comparison of educational standards, attainments, you'll hear cross-state comparisons. I think that's not the right comparison. You should really be thinking about how does a student in Fargo, in terms of educational attainment, how are they comparing to a student in Shanghai or a student in Canada, in Winnipeg? You know, what those are the kinds of, it's really a global economy. And when you talk about education as being this engine of realizing one's potential in the economy of the future, that's going to be forced upon us because of this. The other countries are making this choice, and so our students, our young people, have to make that choice as well. And we have to make those opportunities available to them as well.
To talk about the globalization, agriculture has historically been a strong driver of the economy in this region. How do you see globalization affecting the future of agriculture?
Yeah, I think that agriculture is a continual race between demand and supply conditions. Demand is going up because of the story. When people write the history of the world economy for the last 30 years, the story is China and India. The fact that so many people in those countries have gotten richer and are able to afford more food and better food, that creates a demand for agricultural products. On the other hand, of course, we have the fact that we have innovation, and it's going on all the time and trying to figure out how to improve yields. And so that's been the defining characteristic of human development going back a long ways. This is all a long-winded way of saying is I don't know how that race will unfold over the next 20, 30 years. And I sometimes listen to people only emphasizing the demand piece and saying, boy, this is going to be a really good time for agriculture. That could well happen to be true, but there's people who are trying to meet that demand by figuring out how to improve yields, how to innovate, and it's always that race, and it's never clear how it's going to go. The product of that has been over the past 250, 300 years has been that the supply piece has been winning, but we don't know how that's going to unfold down the road.
If you could just talk a little bit about the tapering program and just touch on how long you think that'll last, and then respond to critics who just say that it leads to the financial instability of the U.S. economy.
Which part? The tapering does? Or, I'm sorry.
Talk a little bit about the tapering program and how long that'll last. And then, like I said, also other question here kind of in relation to that is, some people claim that the program can lead to financial instability.
Okay, so I'll take those in two pieces. So as we headed in December of 2013, the Federal Reserve, the FOMC, the Federal Open Markets Committee, was buying $85 billion per month of longer-term assets. And these purchases were designed to put downward pressure on long-term interest rates. When you buy bonds, that pushes upward in their prices and down in their yields, and that makes it cheaper to borrow for all Americans. So that was the purpose of that program. Beginning at the December meeting, the FOMC began a process of reducing that flow of purchases. And in December, went from 85 down to 75. Then in January, down from 75 to 65, and in March, from 65 to 55. My own expectation, and I'm not speaking for the committee, but I can speak for myself, my own expectation is that that reduction of $10 billion at each meeting in the pace of purchases, this is what's referred to as tapering, it will continue throughout the course of 2014, barring a large change in the economic outlook. This would mean that the program of purchasing assets would end sometime in October or in December. There's a hanging $5 billion, which makes it a little, how you treat that last $5 billion will affect whether we end in October or December. In terms of financial instability, I think that's really a 2013 issue as opposed to a 2014 issue. As I just described, at least my own expectation for the taper is it's actually a fairly systematic, regular process of reduction in the flow of purchases. In 2013, there was a lot of conversation about exactly when would the FOMC begin reducing the flow of purchases. There was a lot of anticipation this would happen, but a lot of uncertainties about when it would happen and how big it would be, what form would it take. And all of these questions generated, I think, instabilities in bond markets and bond yields in particular. The way I've laid out the program, I don't see that kind of instability coming down the road in 2014 at all.
I want to be respectful of the members of the media who are here, and I realize others may have questions, but we do have to move on shortly, so I want to keep the attention focused on those guys. So.
One follow-up question to that. Since the tapering is addressing the bond situation, that interbank rate, you had mentioned that some people are calling for changing that. That might be a dangerous conversation. Is that a more long-term policy then at this point? Is that going to be unchanged?
So what the committee said about that is that the committee anticipates that the Fed funds rate will remain extraordinarily low for a considerable period after the asset purchase program ends. I've just talked about that my own expectation is the asset purchase program will end at the end of this year. So it'll be for a considerable period after that. Now, what does a considerable period mean? That's a very natural follow-up question. And, it's like your mother used to say to you, it depends. It depends on what economic conditions are. If we see it as necessary to keep them low, to provide the backing to the recovery that I think is really necessary, we'll keep them low. If not, then if there are inflationary pressures developing, then we will react to those accordingly.
Gentlemen, anything else?
Well, I want to thank you very much for your time. Thanks for the great questions.